Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to start the program today by talking about a troubling, well, critical moment in the state of Israel. I think one of our most important allies, certainly our most important regional ally in the Middle East, and a nation that is beset now not only by the repercussions of an invasion by Iranian-backed terrorists doing business as the Muslim Brotherhood's franchise, namely Hamas in Gaza, and what has flowed from that invasion, both in terms of Israel's response to it and the concerted efforts by the government of the United States, notwithstanding its professed support for Israel, and that of many others around the world, in the region and beyond, to pressure Israel to relent, to cease fire, at least to create humanitarian pauses of, well, we'll see, uncertain duration. To take stock on what is happening and to really do a sanity check on what not only is being done by the government of Israel, clearly under extreme pressure from the government of the United States, but also what it portends, not just for the people of the Jewish state, but for us as well. I'm very pleased to have with us a friend and colleague now of many years, a man whose truth-telling about what is going on within the Palestinian community, whether it's on the so-called West Bank of Judea and Samaria, or in Gaza, and who has been fearless in pointing out when we're being told lies about the underlying realities. His name is Itamar Marcus. He is the founder and president of a terrific organization, Palestinian Media Watch. His op-ed on these subjects was on the pages of the Wall Street Journal on Monday, and I'm very appreciative of his time always, but particularly at a time such as this. Itamar, welcome back to Securing America, and our condolences to you and your countrymen for what you have been going through, and the prospect that it is not going to get a lot better soon, unfortunately. Give us just, if you would, a quick level setting on the nature of the challenge that you see at the moment from those who are professing that, well, there are lots of Palestinians who just want peace, and if Israel will simply give them a state of their own, that's what they will get.
Well, that's probably the greatest lie that has caused so much incorrect American policy, European policy, and Israeli policy, even for, since the signing of the Oslo Accords. I think the greatest indicator of who the Palestinian people are can be found in a poll that was published literally just a week ago. And it was a poll after the Gaza atrocities that were committed by Hamas, after everyone knew about the rapes, decapitations, and sexual abuse. Everybody knew it. And Palestinians were asked a lot of questions. I'm just going to tell you two of them. First, they were asked, do you support what happened on October 7th? Meaning, do you support what Hamas did? And 75% of the Palestinian population said yes. And about 12% said no. And a few were in the middle. Then they were asked.
Now, when you say the Palestinian population, is this both in Gaza and the West Bank?
Yes, Judea and Samaria and Gaza, the total population now.
And this is a reputable pollster that you have confidence in their findings?
Absolutely. This is the second most important pollster, and we've been following their findings for years, and they're very, very, very good, very professional. The second question, which is of incredible significance, they were asked, did what happened, did it make you feel proud as a Palestinian? And here, it even blew us away. We wouldn't believe it was so high. 98% of Palestinians said that the events of October 7th made them proud. In fact, 94% said they were exceedingly proud, and another 4% said they were somewhat proud. It's shocking. Everybody knew what happened. By the way, the difference between the 98% who were proud and the 75% who supported were probably the people in Gaza who were suffering. So even though they were proud of what happened, they were not happy about it because they figured the damage was worse than the gain of the pride. But they all supported it. They all supported the massacre and the raping. This is the Palestinian population. I know President Biden, soon after this started, said Hamas doesn't represent the Palestinian people. Well, that poll tells us Hamas absolutely, positively represents the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people are Hamas. Hamas are the Palestinian people. And we have to treat the Arabs of Judea and Samaria very much really the same way as we are treating the Hamas today, and not assume that we have a peace partner anywhere or even close to a peace partner.
Itamar, just before we get into sort of the substance of all of this, just another question on the poll. Is it possible that people in the community are responding in those shocking ways because of some perception that that if they respond otherwise, the poll might put them in jeopardy within their community?
No, again, like I said, this is a very reputable pollster. This is not an online poll. This is not a push poll. No. This is a real poll by a real organization. He had some 30 or 40 questions there, all of which pointed in the same direction, by the way. These were the most important findings of the poll.
Okay, so this is why I prize so much your work at Palestinian Media Watch, Itamar. It has been the case, I think, since the inception of your organization decades ago, I guess now, that you have been documenting these realities. You have been fearlessly pointing out not only the sentiments that you've just characterized, but also the lies that were being told about those sentiments, whether it's the English version of what the Palestinian Authority or others are saying, which differs from what they're saying to their own people, or whether it's the promotion of violence and jihad against the Jews coming out of official organs of the Palestinians. You've been making book basically on why it is so that you've got these kinds of sentiments. So I'm sure the results, maybe the 98% was shocking, but basically this is hardly news to you and people who've been following your invaluable work, is it?
It's not news at all. And I just want to tell you one of the reasons why so many Palestinians can support atrocities. And it has to do, 2 weeks into the war, 2 weeks, everybody knew about the atrocities. The Palestinian Authority Ministry of Religion on Thursday published a list of topics that it wanted all the preachers in all the mosques in Judea and Samaria, all the mosques in the West Bank, they wanted to touch on all of these following topics. They do this every week. One of the topics they wanted them to touch on was, and to read to them, was the text of a hadith. It's Islamic law, Islamic tradition, that goes as follows. The hour of resurrection won't come until Muslims fight the Jews and kill them. Jews will hide behind rocks and trees, which will call out, "Muslim servant of Allah, there's a Jew behind me, come and kill him." What the PA, Ministry of Religion, was telling all Palestinians who went to mosques that Friday, was that what happened 2 weeks ago was part of Islam. Killing Jews is part of Islam. The women, the children, everyone. This was not just a nationalistic act by Hamas. This
was the thought. We have to come right back with Itamar Marcus on more of what that means. Straight ahead.
The
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Tributes to Henry Kissinger, dead yesterday at 100, tout his foreign policy expertise and accomplishments. No one will miss him more than the Chinese Communist Party, for whom he was, literally, its oldest old friend, a term reserved for members of Beijing's captured elites. Kissinger's usefulness to the CCP was evident when Chinese dictator Xi Jinping celebrated his centennial birthday during the last of more than 100 visits to what has emerged, with his considerable help, as our greatest enemy ever. In the 6 decades since his first secret trip to China, which actualized Richard Nixon's strategically misbegotten opening, Kissinger arguably did more than any other American to facilitate the Chinese communists' penetration, subversion, and other acts of unrestricted warfare against this country. To be determined is whether in his absence the damage he did can be undone. Good riddance, Henry Kissinger. This is Frank Affney.
We're back. We're visiting with Itamar Marcus, the president, the founder of Palestinian Media Watch, an incredible resource on the truth about what's going on inside this Palestinian community, both under the governance, such as it is, of the Palestinian Authority. The guys we're endlessly told are the good guys, as well as under Hamas, which rules Gaza. And would rule the West Bank if the matter were put to a vote. Itamar, I can't overstate the importance of what you were just sharing with us, and I hated to cut you off, but we had a hard break. Just to refine the point, what that hadith, which is supposedly citing sacred writ from Muhammad himself, talking about Jews as apes and pigs, and the rocks and trees crying out to come kill them, the Jews, that is, oh Muslims. It's so completely obvious if you spend even a moment looking at it clearly that there is a, well, I impute it to Sharia, mandate for not just anti-Semitism, but, you know, the mass murder of Jews from the river to the sea, among other places, as they say. So just a word on how it is that we find ourselves unable to recognize that reality. Again, not that all Muslims want to kill all Jews, but unfortunately that those who embrace and adhere to and, you know, are furthering the dictates of this Islamic code called Sharia, absolutely do.
The Palestinian Authority absolutely does. And whereas they could easily find sources within Islam that recognize Israel and could be interpreted as supporting Zionism, the Palestinian Authority chooses those sources like this one to tell their people that the killing of Jews is something that Allah wants. In that particular source, the redemption of humanity, the resurrection, is conditioned on exterminating Jews. The Palestinian Authority chose to broadcast it now, and that is what is so critical. We have to understand the Palestinian Authority is not this secular government like Washington wants us to believe. They are also religiously motivated. And the Palestinian population, by the way, is much more Muslim than they are Palestinian. If they had to choose between the identity, and there have been polls about this, are you a Palestinian first or a Muslim first? The overwhelming majority says Muslim first. They are Muslims. This is in their blood for generations and generations. So when they are told that they have to kill Jews, not in the name of Palestinianism, but because this is what Allah wants, you will end up with 98% of the Palestinian population being proud of the massacre and destruction of Jews.
Yeah. So, Itamar, going back to where I began, I wanted to do kind of a sanity check on the insistence that at the end of all of this, if Israel, in fact, can destroy Hamas, as I believe it must, as it says it intends to. And that seems to be, and you might comment on this, Itamar, now pretty much a universal view within Israel, at least the Jews of Israel. But we're told that when it's all over, there must be a two-state solution. There must be a Palestinian state, and it must be run by this Palestinian Authority, evidently, that will live side by side in peace with Israel. From your perspective, informed by all of the work you've done over all these years, as well as what is happening as we speak, including that most recent poll, is this anything other than, well, insanity, but a formula for the destruction of the Jewish state?
Yes, foreign countries' leadership around the world that pushes Israel, that believes that, it's a function of willful blindness, because every bit of evidence and every single message that the Palestinian leadership has told their people, what they've educated their children, is that the goal of this entire process is Israel's destruction. You ask any Palestinian child, if they've been learning in school that the goal is to live side by side with Israel, they would laugh at you. They are all learning the message from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, in their own language, in their own maps, in their own messages, both for nationalistic reasons and for Islamic reasons. The anti-Semitism is so powerful in the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority teaches their people that the Jews were hated all over the world. And that's why a state of Israel was created, because everybody wanted to get rid of their Jews. And now they are the ones who are suffering from the Jews, and therefore they have a right to get rid of them as well. These are the messages the Palestinians give their people. So yeah. For every...
One other facet of it being that the Israelis now occupy land that rightly belongs to Muslims. They have no real historic attachment to that land. Is that right?
What they teach also is that under Islamic law, any land that was once ruled by a Muslim, and then during the Ottoman Empire, and also before, there were periods when the land of Israel was under Muslim rule. And therefore, they're saying it is considered what's called holy waqf. It's waqf land, means Muslim land, and every Muslim in the world has an obligation to liberate waqf land. By the way, this is true of Spain as well. And Absolutely. Every once in a while, Palestinians talk about, we have to liberate Spain from the Christians because Spain must be Islamic as well.
Yeah, well, there's parts of Eastern Europe as well that I think they're setting their sights on. In fact, let's be clear, they, under Sharia, and believe that the entire world will be under Muslim rule in due course. Itamar, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but I do want to touch on one last point that I know is something, again, you've really specialized in. There is a practice under the Palestinian Authority of not only inculcating this jihadism and hatred of the Jews and desire to destroy Israel in schools and, you know, with their naming of their sports arenas and so on, for those who have martyred themselves for that purpose. But there's also a practice of rewarding those who have survived or the families of those who've died in the process of killing Jews, with subventions from the authority, including money that we're providing to help the Palestinian people, we're told. I wanted to ask you this question in the context, Itamar, of the releases of large numbers of prisoners, some who have not been charged, we're told, from Israeli jails, in exchange for a fraction of that number of hostages that the Palestinians of Hamas seized in the course of this invasion. Just calibrate with us what is going on here, the numerical disparity for one thing, but the whole point of equating these two populations in any way.
Of course, every Israeli who is there is an innocent victim of kidnapping and being taken for the purpose of being a hostage. The Palestinians are all either convicted terrorists, or they're people who were very much involved in promoting terror, organizing terror, and the information about this came from Palestinians whose lives would be in danger if they testified in court. And therefore, the information is given quietly to the Israeli judges, who are very, very careful about law. And if the information is completely credible, the people are guilty of crimes that they should be in jail for, then Israel will put them under what's called administrative detention. The overwhelming majority, probably 95% of Palestinians or more who are imprisoned, have been convicted and tried for terror offensive. A small percentage are people who we cannot afford to endanger the Palestinians who've helped us track down and help prevent the terror.
So, but unfortunately, when we're out of time, Itamar, I regret to say, they're being turned loose to do harm again to Israelis, I fear, among others.
Tragically.
Bless you for your work at Palestinian Media Watch. Itamar Marcus, thank you for your time today. Come back to us with updates soon, if you will. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to be able to say hello to a next guest under a slightly revised pronunciation of his name. I think I've been mispronouncing it all these years, and I'm going to try to get it right. His name is Colonel Grant Newsham, United States Marine Corps, retired, a man of very considerable accomplishment, both in uniform and subsequent to taking it off as a foreign service officer in the Embassy of the United States in Tokyo, as well as an entrepreneur and businessman in the Western Pacific. He has been one of our founding members of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and I'm proud to say, as a member of our team at the Center for Security Policy, as one of our senior fellows, he is the author most recently of an incredibly timely and important book. It's called When China Attacks. Colonel Newsom, welcome aboard, sir. Good to have you back.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
I think I just mispronounced it again.
That's okay.
I'm going to have to reprogram. Hillary Clinton, paging Hillary Clinton. I'm going to need a reprogram.
Whatever works.
Colonel Newsham, thank you for joining us. I wanted to start by talking to you about a report that we're going to be featuring as the subject of our next Committee on the Present Danger China webinar, in which you will be a featured participant, I'm happy to say. It'll be taped on Thursday, whatever that is, 30th of November, from 1 p.m. to 2:15 p.m. Eastern Time. And I strongly encourage all of our audience to tune in. You can subscribe to those programs. They're very, very, I think, important sources of information about both the threat we face from Communist China, a subject in which Grant has spent most of his professional life, as well as the danger that arises from enemies within the United States, friends of China, as they call them, who are collaborating in what seems to be an assiduous effort to destroy this country from without, or better yet, from the Chinese point of view, from within. And Grant, the report we're going to be talking about is one that just was issued about a week after the Chinese communist dictator Xi Jinping was feted in San Francisco. The report came out of the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party. As I say, a week later, I'm a little suspicious that maybe they held it up until after Xi had cleared the country. But either way, it documents that pretty much just down the road from San Francisco, outside Fresno, Xi Jinping had a secret biological laboratory that appears to have been, according to this committee report, chock-a-block with deadly pathogens, with the means to replicate them, and even genetically modified mice for getting at least COVID-19 and perhaps other diseases spread around. And I'm interested in getting your take on this. We'll talk about it more on Thursday. But what on earth are we to make of this facility, do you think?
Well, we ought to be concerned. I mean, and scared to death, actually, is a better way to put it. One thing to keep in mind is that this was only discovered by accident. It was a complete accident. And makes you wonder, well, how many more are there? And what you're seeing is the Chinese very effectively using, let's call it Chinese businessmen, to do their bidding. And it's very easy to do. It's very good if you're an intelligence service because it gives you a lot of cover. And all you have to do is kind of give some directions and turn them loose. And these guys have a real sort of natural sort of flair for business. And they're aggressive, assertive, and they don't mind taking risks. And I think that's what we saw here is the Chinese security services using their Chinese businessmen for their own purposes. And as I said, we just got lucky on this one. So what else
Big
is
time.
There?
Big time. Let's drill down on that in a couple of ways. One of the things that the committee found is that the businessman that was running this operation in California had been apparently a fugitive from justice in Canada, where he was wanted in connection with some $330 million, as I recall, worth of criminal enterprise up there. He was getting transfers of $1 million or more from Chinese banks for unknown purposes, but presumably associated with this lab. And the fact is, as best I can tell, this could have been, especially in the hands of the kinds of people who seem to be coming here in very large numbers, namely maybe tens of thousands of military age unaccompanied Chinese men who seem to trained observers to look an awful lot like special forces personnel. If they had their hands on, you know, well, Ebola, for example, which apparently was in this lab, to say nothing of HIV and COVID and other nasty pathogens, actual weaponizable weapons of mass destruction unleashed inside America. Is that a over-the-top scenario, or do you think that's entirely possible given what we know?
Well, I think for the Chinese to do otherwise would be out of character. It's perfectly in line with their doctrine, chemical warfare, biological warfare, to do these things. And they have been active in particularly biological weapons, weapons research as well. And apparently, according to reports, very scary stuff. And as I said, if they weren't thinking of doing this, if they weren't planning to do it, that would be out of character. It's very much just their doctrine. You know, just as we, you know, just have rules of how we operate and we do it as standard, this would be what they do. There's nothing surprising about this.
Grant, as you know, we published a book called The Indictment in May to talk a bit about various aspects of what the Chinese are doing to wage unrestricted warfare against us. And as you rightly point out, and you contributed through your many, many interventions with these various webinars to the book, one of the very important takeaways for me from it was a speech that was given by a former defense minister of China at the time, 20 years ago. He was in that job. He was a general by the name of Chi Ha Chen. And one of the things he reported in this speech to a closed meeting of party cadre, apparently, was that the China, to your point, to the doctrine, the Chinese Communist Party's illegal biological warfare program had as its mission, from Deng Xiaoping, no less, one of the general secretaries of its party, depopulating the United States with biological warfare. And when you look at, you know, especially the possibility that we may have more of these labs still operating in this country, we certainly have large numbers of these guys who presumably have trained to, you know, deal with them. Could this possibly be part of that unrestricted warfare strategy, building upon, you know, the proof of concept they did with COVID, to light yet another of these brush fires around the world, unfortunately, including inside this country, to advance their agenda when China attacks, as you've put it, in Taiwan and perhaps beyond in the Pacific?
Oh, you have to assume that it is. I think to do otherwise would be just malfeasance. And the Chinese look at this as have like a carpenter with a toolkit, and he's got a lot of tools in it. And this is just one of their attack vectors. And it's not new. It's not as if the Chinese have just thought of this. It's been sort of part of Chinese thinking for a long time. And even before the communists, it's not as if they didn't know about biological warfare. But the Chinese have, with a lot of things, the Chinese communists have just made it nastier and weaponized it in ways that we would prefer not to think about. But you saw, as you mentioned, you saw what happened with COVID, and that was at best, just a sort of an opportunity that the Chinese took advantage of at worst with something much more malicious.
Oh, a deliberate BW attack, mm-hmm. I would call it. Yeah. And by the way, that was one of the findings of our mm-hmm. report, as you know, on Team B3. Yeah. Let me just drill down on that for a moment, Grant, because one of the things that that if indeed this is part of the plan, would be particularly stunning is that when you look at the fact that a week before this report came out, as I said, Xi Jinping was being wined and dined, I mean, to the tune of $40,000 a pop for these executives coming in to sit at his head table, for example. How blind, I guess, to put it charitably, are we to the true nature of the Chinese Communist Party? Is this just a function of that technique, one of the lines of attack of elite capture, or is this a far more comprehensive failure on the part of our country to understand what we're up against?
Well, I think once the Chinese have got enough elites, enough of these masters of the universe, that the rest kind of takes care of itself, or they've had a huge success at that point. And even though there are a lot of Americans who understand this very well, and even on Capitol Hill, you know, Representative Gallagher's just one of a number of people who understand very well what the Chinese are, what they are up to, and trying to do something about it. But when you've got the people who control a lot of money, control a lot of the economy, who are, that's what it comes down to, you know, it's the donor class, and they will get politicians who understand that it's wrong to deal with the Chinese this way, to just go along because they need the cash.
Hold the thought. We'll be right back with more with Colonel.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Tributes to Henry Kissinger, dead yesterday at 100, tout his foreign policy expertise and accomplishments. No one will miss him more than the Chinese Communist Party, for whom he was, literally, its oldest old friend, a term reserved for members of Beijing's captured elites. Kissinger's usefulness to the CCP was evident when Chinese dictator Xi Jinping celebrated his centennial birthday during the last of more than 100 visits to what has emerged, with his considerable help, as our greatest enemy ever. In the 6 decades since his first secret trip to China, which actualized Richard Nixon's strategically misbegotten opening, Kissinger arguably did more than any other American to facilitate the Chinese communists' penetration, subversion, and other acts of unrestricted warfare against this country. To be determined is whether in his absence the damage he did can be undone. Good riddance, Henry Kissinger. This is Frank Affney.
Back. We are continuing our very, very important conversation, very timely one, with Colonel Grant Newsham, United States Marine Corps retired, senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, the author of a terrific new book, When China Attacks. I commend it to all of you. Colonel Newsham, you have from your vantage point, mostly in Japan, a sort of ringside seat on what is taking place inside China. You've been studying it closely for many years in your various incarnations, but is it overstating the case to suggest that at the moment, the Chinese Communist Party is in considerable difficulty, economically, politically, and demographically, among other ways?
Well, it is. It's in a lot of trouble. It also has a lot of problems. Trouble is sort of depends on what we make of it and also what the Chinese, the communist leaders themselves make of it. But they do have all the problems that you've mentioned. But what you do see is Xi Jinping trying to get the country ready for war. It includes making it so it can handle economic pressure, economic sanctions. That's part of the reason they're building up so much coal. They're the coal industry. They're building practically a plant a day, it seems. But also, is it getting people ready? And also, they have putting in a new system. It's like the old communist era sort of block wardens, where you would have these people who are responsible for each neighborhood block and busybodies and kept an eye on everything. And it's very interesting how they are pushing this down to the lowest levels once again. And obviously, it's for control. And it does show you also that China does have some real concerns. The Chinese communists have real concerns about the population. It's not as if the Chinese don't know when they've been dealt a bad hand, when they're being mistreated. You saw that with their response to the COVID crackdowns. So the regime does have some very serious concerns about the reliability of their public and just how committed they are to the Communist Party. So they're trying to control that. But this is all getting ready for a possible shooting war.
Yeah. Again, that stands in such stark contrast to the way we were treating Xi when he was here. When I say we, I mean, obviously, the Biden mm-hmm. administration, Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, and these executives, among others. Grant, I just wanted to say, to your point about this renewed commitment to totalitarian control on an unprecedented scale, the difference, of course, between what they used to do with these, you know, monitors at the very local level, the tattletales, the, you know, spies, what have you, they have now introduced this comprehensive technological means of acquiring information and processing it through, you know, big data algorithms and quantum computing and all the rest, such that we're told they actually have real-time knowledge of where everybody is in China and what they're doing and what they're thinking and what they're transacting and where they work and so on. The social credit system, I guess. But this sounds as though what they're doing now, and our friend Chris Chappelle at China Uncensored, as you may know, done a recent very interesting video about mm-hmm. how they seem to be actually cutting back on their massive police establishment in favor of this more efficient way of both surveilling and monitoring, yes, but also controlling the population. And to the end of making sure that it will do what it's told in time of war, especially, this is another straw in the wind. So to those who are saying, well, China's in such trouble, it can't really be posing a threat to us, would you say, as the French like to say, au contraire, to the contrary, that maybe their troubles may further impel them to the kind of war that they seem to be preparing for?
I think it's more likely that will happen than that they will just curl up in a ball and apologize for everything they've done. The Chinese can absorb all sorts of difficulties that would drive us Americans completely nuts. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Plus, it is a classic response of these kind of regimes to distract attention from domestic problems and lash out. And you also may see that the lashing out is actually a very principled, sensible thing to do from their perspective. Particularly if you can grab Taiwan in the process and really assert your dominance in the region. Well, that, from Xi Jinping's perspective, well, why not? We wouldn't want him to do it, but he may think it's a perfectly sensible thing to do. So the idea that they've got so many problems, they just don't need more of them, it's an argument, but I think it's probably the wrong one.
Yeah. You know, the one of the horribles that I mentioned that they're afflicted by at the moment is a function of their one child policy that has left them with, by some estimates, I think Gordon Chang says it's 40 million men, military age, by the way, for whom there are no women because they murdered in the womb, you know, on a, shall we say, sex preference basis. 80% of the 400 million or so they say they've killed were females. So Grant, again, would it serve the purpose of the party to contend with that kind of demographic challenge, particularly people who are, you know, able-bodied sorts and might be considerably unhappy with the regime and their fate, to dispatch them as cannon fodder off to distant parts of the world as part of this, you know, effort to sustain the party, of course, in its control at home, but also to achieve its global hegemonic ambitions?
Well, it might be. You know, particularly these kind of regimes, they don't mind having a million or two people die. And it is a problem they have to deal with. And if you can reduce the problem one way or the other, either by war, as you said, send them overseas to just get rid of them. Well, why not? There's an argument, of course, well, these are so many only children in China that families would get so upset if these people started dying in any sort of numbers. But once again, it's an argument, but I'm not sure it's a good one.
Yeah, especially since they don't get a vote. Grant Newsham is in the house. We'll be right back with more final installment. Stay tuned. We're back for our final installment with Colonel Grant Newsham, the United States Marine Corps colonel who went on to serve his country in a variety of other roles, including as a foreign service officer out in the Western Pacific, a man of considerable talent and a great resource for this program, among other things. Grant, I wanted to ask you to, given that you are forward deployed, as we say, sort of look around the neighborhood from your vantage point in Japan to see how what's transpiring here. On the one hand, the obvious evidence, if we wish to see it, of increasing aggressiveness on the part of the Chinese Communist Party. On the one hand, greater and greater capabilities to engage in aggression. The United States seemingly giving most of it a pass, not rousing itself to respond appropriately. And the evident concerns about, you know, China's own internal stability possibly translating into more of these kinds of aggressive designs. Let's start with, if we could, Korea, because it looks to me as though that's ripe to be another of the brush fires that Xi Jinping starts. How do the South Koreans assessing their situation at the moment?
Well, the South Koreans, I don't think, have ever been more worried about North Korea. The North Korean military capabilities have improved to the point where the United States had better be worried. And we used to just laugh it off. And they're starving to death, a bunch of dwarfs who can't fight. Well, they've got long-range missiles, nuclear weapons, satellites, and building submarines as well. And the South Koreans see this as well. And they're also, they are alarmed by what they see, even more than they usually are. There's no great love between South Korea and China, of course, at least with the current administration. Yeah, but the South Koreans, they know that the North Korean sort of threat is entirely Chinese created, and they will call it, they will order North Korea into action when the time comes to keep give South Korea all the problems they can handle.
Yeah. South Korea and us mm-hmm. as well, given yeah. you've got troops up there and, mm-hmm. you know, vital interests. Okay, so that's a bad situation that could go considerably worse very quickly. The Philippines, we've seen the Chinese asserting themselves to the point of actually ramming Philippine ships, as I understand it. How do the Filipinos regard what's happening?
Well, they have stood up for themselves. At least a lot of the Filipinos have, and the current administration has really shifted the Philippines back towards the United States, seen where its interests and its protection theoretically lies. And that relationship is actually pretty good. The Americans have played it rather well. But now the Chinese have called America's bluff. And as you've described, they are particularly with the ramming of Philippine ships. And also the Chinese are moving in different parts of Philippine waters that don't get much attention. And there's a fear that they're going to try to take those and build some new islands. And the Americans are now in a position of having to put up or shut up. We've said how much we support the Philippines, what a great relationship it now is, how much it's improved. But the Chinese are now saying, well, what are you going to do? And it's probably going to take more than a couple joint patrols to have the Chinese back off. And the Philippines are watching closely to see how much we are really friends of theirs.
Yeah, reliable friends, most mm-hmm. especially. Okay, let's go to Japan. This is a nation that has, I think, made very clear that they see their vital interests are being jeopardized as well. Their own waters, their own islands are being increasingly under pressure from the Chinese as well. What are your friends in Japan making of both the Biden administration's response to all of this as well as the threat?
Well, I think they're unfortunately hoping the Americans take care of things. Yes, the Japanese are well aware of the Chinese threat more than they ever have been. They're trying to improve their own national defense, improve their military, but it's being done in a haphazard way. And it's partly because they just don't know what to do. How do you get ready for a war? How do you build up a military that hasn't actually thought fighting a war was on the menu for decades? And the Americans ought to help them out and show them what they need to do, how to do it, and also what we need them to do. We've been too reticent. So while there is a lot of concern and there is some movement, I don't know that it's been enough of what it needs to be. And the Japanese are having a hard time of getting away from this really ingrained notion that the Americans will make up for any shortcomings in Japan's defense. Well, those days are over, and we actually need Japan to do a lot more. I'm not sure it's moving as it should, despite all the good talk.
Which brings us to Taiwan. The Taiwanese have recently been unveiling a number of new weapon systems, including some that it would appear have the reach to hit targets in China itself. I guess one could ask this of at least the South Koreans and the Japanese as well, but is it your estimation, Colonel, that these guys may as well have nuclear capabilities that could be mounted on some of those weapon systems as well to try to establish a deterrent that they may no longer see reliably coming from the United States?
I haven't seen or heard anything which suggests that the Taiwanese do have nuclear weapons. They were well on the way to having them back in the 80s, as I recall. That was shut down by the Americans, basically. But I say I'm not aware that they have that capability. They could probably get it pretty quickly if they wanted. But they are building some very interesting weaponry that can reach into China and cause some harm. Now they need to build an awful lot more of it. So it's a good, it's a step in the right direction. But the Taiwanese do need to do a lot more for their own defense. Once again, you're trying to catch up for years of ignoring a problem,
right,
just as we are.
Yeah. Well, and the failure of the United States to help more to this point, I think, as well as what it's doing at the moment. Colonel, just last question on this. Is it your estimation that the time that the Taiwanese, or for that matter, we have to do much about their deterrent posture is rapidly closing, that the Chinese may, in fact, act after this election in January for the president of Taiwan?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. I think if the DPP, the current administration, if they sort of are successful in the, or excuse me, the current party, if they're successful, China is going to quite possibly play rough.
We'll be following it closely, as will you, my friend. God bless you. Colonel Grant Newsham, United States Marine Corps, retired. Come back to us soon. Hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.